I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. An informed citizenry is considered vital to a well-functioning democracy. And since we live in the information age, you would think that there would be more consensus on the issues, more agreement on basic facts. But as we are learning this election season, this is not the case. Perhaps too much information, true and false, just confuses things. We're going to explore why people believe what they do, why it's so hard to change minds, and why we cling to political misinformation, even lies. But let's begin with some fact-checking. And we ask Angie Drobnik-Holland to join us. She is editor of PolitiFact. And Angie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. PolitiFact has been around for, I guess this is the third election cycle that you've been around for. Is this one any more or less truthful or dishonest?
Well, it certainly seems like we have an unusual candidate in Donald Trump who gets a lot of facts wrong. And when I compare him to the other candidates that we fact-checked for the presidency, the other nominees, his record is much worse. So that's comparing him with John McCain, Mitt Romney, Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton. He seems to get a lot of facts wrong. And frankly, he gets things, big things wrong and little things wrong, too. So a lot of negative ratings for him.
In fact, I think looking at your site, he got something like a mix of mostly false, and pants on fire. Something like 67% of what he says that you have evaluated falls under those categories.
Yes, it's about three-quarters of his statements get either mostly false, or pants on fire. And, you know, some of this, I think, is due to Trump's unusual background. He's never held elective office. He is not a practiced politician. Most of the people who run for the presidency have several years in public office, some of them many years. Trump has not held elective office. He's talking about a lot of public policy issues that are really complicated, international trade, immigration, health care. And he comes out of the New York real estate world and the world of reality television. So one of the things that stuck out to me very early on in watching Trump's candidacy is that he seemed to talk off the cuff a lot without using notes or seemingly having read any kind of briefing books or anything like that, like the more traditional candidates. And I would say this is not a I do not see this as a particularly partisan issue, because if you also look on the Republican side, a candidate who got a lot of his facts correct was Jeb Bush, who was very much into policy and really absorbed himself in the details of say, education or immigration. And Jeb Bush's accuracy record was much better than Trump's.
That's fascinating. How do you, though, score something? And I'm thinking of Donald Trump talking about guns in schools recently, where he seemed to contradict himself, you know, within a couple of minutes of what he said. Where do you score that? How do you determine what that is?
You know, those are very difficult. Those are very difficult statements for us to report about. We recently did a story we called Trying to Pin Down What Donald Trump Thinks About Abortion, the Minimum Wage, Taxes, and U.S. Debt, where we looked at the way he kind of goes back and forth on things, like on abortion. He said women should be punished, and then he came back later and said no. And that one was a pretty clear reversal. In other cases, he sometimes seems to contradict himself in the same comments. And I would say it's challenging. As fact checkers, one of our core principles is transparency. So we write about what he says or what happens. And when it doesn't make sense, we just say, like, this seems contradictory. This doesn't make this doesn't seem to be consistent. So we're just trying to give people information so that they have the same information that we have, and we're not trying to make things make sense or anything like that.
Having to sort of follow the lead of whoever the candidate is, but it is interesting. You mentioned Jeb Bush got a better score, if I can put it that way, from PolitiFact, and yet, as we know, was not able to make it very far in the Republican primary season. What does that tell you, or what does that tell us about how supporters or voters think about things like facts?
truth?
You know, I get asked this question a lot. I think that the candidates' grasp of public policy and their grasp of facts and figures is one of the criteria that voters use to evaluate them. But it's not the only criteria. And I think clearly we saw that on the Republican side this year. Voters in the Republican primary just seemed like they were tired of people with long track records in public office. Mm. It just seemed like there's a lot of discontent in the Republican Party about where elected leaders have taken them. And we've seen this in other races. You know, Eric Cantor, surprisingly, lost his race. He was one of the Republican leaders in the House. We saw John Boehner resign the speakership. I mean, it's there's some things going on in the Republican Party right now where there's a lot of discontent between the leadership and between the rank and file voters sometimes.
Well, let me segue to the Democrats and to Hillary Clinton. And, you know, from a lot of the polling that we see, her negatives are almost as bad as Donald Trump's negatives. How do you explain that? And again, looking at PolitiFact, when you score some of her either misstatements or false statements or perhaps even pants on fire, she's more like 29% as opposed to 76%. But it seems the public perception is that she is dishonest.
Yes, you know, it's been very interesting watching Hillary Clinton because we've been fact-checking her since the 2007 race. We fact-checked her quite a bit when she competed against Barack Obama. She is, I will tell you, some of our critics will say, oh, this is the liberal media, to which I would say, I really don't think so. And I just want to state that up front.
Sure.
Hillary Clinton is a real policy wonk. She seems to really get into the details of issues, whether it's foreign policy or education. You know, one thing she's talked a lot on the campaign trail is prescription drug abuse, and she often cites facts and figures about that. She's very careful. She has a background as a lawyer, and sometimes her answers come across as very lawyerly. The thing that I see is, like, I think voters are more concerned, and the questions she gets are about consistency and secretiveness. But speaking from a fact checker's point of view, she
right.
doesn't misstate facts that often. She's very cautious. I mean, like any politician, every politician that we rate, once we've done enough fact checks on them, I mean, everybody gets stuff wrong sometimes. They exaggerate. Like recently, here's an example with Hillary Clinton on the Sunday show. She said she didn't think Bernie Sanders had a single negative campaign ad run against him. Well, we rated that false because it was so completely and literally untrue. He has had negative campaign ads run against him. But I suspect that, like, in her mind, and I think any of us could relate to this, she was thinking, like, well, he hasn't faced the same negative ads that I have, which is a different statement. But those are the kinds of things, like, that we find politicians routinely exaggerating. It's like they're arguing against their opponent, and they just kind of get a little they have some point in their mind, and then they get a little carried away. Those are kind of the routine political falsehoods we see with everybody.
And I do want to talk about Bernie Sanders, but what I think is interesting about Hillary Clinton is that she has, because she's been in the public eye for so many years, we know where she stood on same-sex marriage. She has evolved on that. We know where she stood on some trade agreements, and she has changed her mind on that. Of course, there was Hillary Care back in the 90s, so she's got some track record on health care. Has that been helpful to her? Do you think it's hurt her?
You know, I think it remains to be seen. I think that's one of the big discussions that's going to happen over the next 6 months is that is Hillary Clinton's long track record in the public eye, and how do voters feel about that? On same-sex marriage, you know, Barack Obama changed on that point as well,
right.
And many other Democratic politicians have. So I don't know. I mean, do voters see that as something that they want to punish her for by not voting for her, or do they see that as something that they understand?
Is that a flip-flop?
Yeah, it's more of a flip-flop. I mean, you know, and we often hear from readers who will email us and say, oh, Hillary lies. But when we drill down into it, it's often about her, about flip-flops, about how lawyerly she is in some of her responses. We've written several long stories about her email. She kept her Secretary of State's email in a private account on a private server.
Right.
And one of the things she keeps saying is, I never sent or received messages that were marked classified. Well, that's very narrowly true that we know of, but what she doesn't say there is what an unusual setup this was. No other Secretary of State had a private server. One or two may have used a private email address, but not a private server like this.
Let me look at Bernie Sanders here. You have for him true 14%, mostly true 36%, half true 19%, mostly false 18%, false 12%, and zero pants on fire. So looking at Bernie Sanders, does he, in a sense, score better than the other candidates when it comes to truthfulness?
He hasn't got any pants on fire.
He doesn't.
So by that standard, he's doing better. Bernie Sanders, watching him, he likes to cite a lot of statistics to support his views on income inequality and on federal spending. And he wants to see more social spending. He wants to see less spending on things like the military and other things that he deems as wasteful or helping corporate America. We've found that sometimes the statistics that Bernie Sanders uses are out of date. That's one thing where we've given him some negative ratings on. But he's one. He's another one I would put in the category of policy wonk. And he seems to study the issues. So we haven't gotten him on a lot of inaccuracies.
And you bet a minute before I have to say goodbye to you, does this seem like a very busy campaign season for fact checkers like your organization?
Definitely. It's been very busy. Donald Trump is really good at getting headlines, and he's really good at getting in front of TV cameras and making provocative statements. As fact checkers, we choose our statements by what's in the news and would the average person say, I wonder if that's true. And by those criteria, Donald Trump makes a lot of statements that are ripe for fact-checking. Now, we fact-check all the candidates, and we are trying to give voters the information they need so they can make choices and govern themselves in a democracy. So it's been very busy. And the other thing I've seen is a lot of media outlets now are doing more fact-checking because voters and readers and the audience, they want fact-checking. They want to know after these big debates and big events what was said was accurate or not. So in that sense, it's very heartening that voters want to read about fact-checking.
Well, Angie, we have to end on that note. Angie Drobnik, Holan, thanks for joining us on Radio Times today.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Editor of PolitiFact. We will be talking more about facts and checking facts and misinformation. After this very short break, we've got two guests who will be joining us in just a couple of about 90 seconds. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're talking about facts and why people don't necessarily believe facts and why sometimes we're not so particularly rational about facts and why we cling to political misinformation and even lies. Joining us is Peter Ditto, professor of psychology and social behavior at the University of California at Irvine, joining us from the studios of KUCL in Irvine, California. Peter Ditto, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Thanks for getting up so early.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Jason Reifler, associate professor of politics at the University of Exeter in the United Kingdom. And Jason Reifler, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me, too.
You're welcome. Peter, let me begin with you. And I just said goodbye to Angie Drobnik-Holan. She's the editor of PolitiFact, one of several sites that fact-check what politicians say, what campaigns say about themselves and each other. Do these sites matter? And by that, I mean, do they change people's minds?
I don't think that they do. So the problem is that people sort of think emotionally, and they, kind of absorb the things that they want to believe and reject the things that they don't. And even fact checkers, so you could see that, PolitiFact, some of these other organizations come in and they they're the referee. They're the umpire in this, but you can always doubt their umpire as well. So, and that's what happens is when PolitiFact agrees with you, you sort of accept that it's true when it doesn't. It's like, no, you know, that organization's biased as well. It's tough to get out of this. People are very facile at kind of believing the things that they want to believe.
And is Donald Trump exhibit A for that? According to PolitiFact, about three quarters of what he says doesn't really hold up.
Yeah, I mean, at some level, it's not very different, right? I mean, people's ideology biases their beliefs. And this is what I study, that people can shape things. They'll accept the facts that they want to believe and reject the ones they don't. Donald Trump has moved this in sort of a different realm in a sense that usually people want to have some factual, you know, something to kind of back them up. And there's a sense in which some of the Trump supporters don't seem to even care. They'll acknowledge that the facts don't fit. They'll acknowledge that what Donald Trump says doesn't really, might not even be true. He might not even mean it. And they don't seem to care. Again, they're sort of interested in him, and their passion for him and their like for him is what seems to shape all the rest of their beliefs.
Well, let me get you in on the conversation, Jason. Are political beliefs more about things like identity or beliefs even more than facts?
I think that they are. So when people have a particular view of the world, when they see, you know, the they have beliefs sort of what they think is right or wrong, that it can be very difficult to get them to change those, and how they turn to talk somebody out of a political opinion isn't all that much easier than trying to talk somebody out of a fact that isn't true that they would like to continue believing. If you are, I went to Duke, and so if you're a huge Duke basketball fan, it's going to be hard to talk me into wanting to support Carolina.
To put it on a really basic level, Peter Ditto, the something that you said that I circled here, which I thought was actually quite revealing. You said people think they think like scientists, but they really think like lawyers. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, so that's a good way to characterize this motivated reasoning phenomenon, is we think that sort of ideally we think scientists take a bunch of facts and then sort of agnostically decide on what the conclusion is, right? So they build it from the bottom up. But people really think a lot more like lawyers. They have a conclusion that they want to reach. So lawyers have a conclusion, and they harness facts to support those beliefs. So they're paid to do that, and they understand that they're doing that. But people don't, right? They don't realize that sort of they have this sort of conclusion in mind. They want to support Donald Trump. They want to support Hillary Clinton. And that when reverse engineer the facts to support their beliefs. And there's a lot of evidence that, you know, thinking is really a lot more like arguing than it is like reasoning. Huh. So we argue for our points. We come up with ways to support the things that we want to believe, and we pick the facts that we want. We reject the ones that we don't. And, we end up with this world in which we've got red facts and blue facts. Right, so that's the culture war in some ways is really a fact war now, where we've got the liberals believe certain things to be true, conservatives believe other things to be true, and it's very difficult to get them to sort of find some middle ground. And it's hard to have a conversation. It's hard to find some compromise when you just begin with different sets of facts. Right. I mean, if I believe that that the Earth's been warming for the last few decades, and you say no, it isn't. No, it hasn't. I say yes, it has. You say no, it hasn't.
Not very helpful.
Right. So you don't get very far from that, right? And that's really this problem, is that people can find the facts to support the things that they want to believe.
Jason, let me go back to you, and I wonder, even just with the intensity of a political campaign, you're joining us from the United Kingdom. Things are pretty intense here in the United States over this political campaign season. Does the kind of intensity of a campaign harden people's points of view?
Yeah, it does. And I think it does for a variety of reasons. One, as we get closer to Election Day, people start paying closer attention to politics. Most of the time, our day-to-day lives, if we don't pay close attention to what's going on in campaigns or electoral politics or D.C., it doesn't affect us that much. But as the election comes close and we have to make a decision and think about who we're going to vote for, we start paying closer attention to the news and what politicians are saying, and we do it in exactly the ways that Peter was describing before, in which we sort of really pay attention to the stuff that we like, and the stuff that we like we accept very uncritically, and the stuff that we don't like we apply a lot of effort to try and counter-argue, so that as we get closer and we're paying closer attention, and the sort of heat rises, and there's you know, more and more at stake, and it raises the temperature, and all of those things that Peter was saying that it's hard to do, it makes it that much harder to do in that type of environment.
I mean, Jason, it sounds very, and some of this feels very tribal.
Yeah, no, I think that that's, I think that that's a great analogy in terms of when we have our partisan and ideological loyalties, and it is really tribal. And, you know, not to sort of use the same analogy over and over again, but in some ways it's kind of like sports, like those Duke and Carolina or Villanova loyalties that people have, that, you know, they're pretty deeply ingrained, the things that we've been learning over our entire lives, and they're not easily given up.
Well, I mean, Peter, I think for all of us, it's really hard to admit if we've made a mistake or that we are wrong about something.
Yeah, I mean, people will do that, you know, a little bit, and they'll switch. They'll say, "Well, I was wrong about that fact, but well, here's another one." So if it's really, again, it's really the conclusion that matters. We think about that people have these facts or reasons that feed into a conclusion, but the conclusion that matters, and the facts are sort of interchangeable. And so I can admit that. Well, you know, yeah, sure, Donald Trump lied about that. But he's really great about this, or, you know, he lied about that. But Hillary Clinton's really, really terrible about, you know, on the same dimension. She, you know, what about all the ways that she lies? And so people, these things are sort of interchangeable. And that's really the interesting thing about human thinking, is how people can kind of walk this line between what they want to believe and what they have to believe based on the facts. And again, we're very good at that. And we'll let a little bit of information in, but we'll then, you know, decide that there's, you know, that's mitigated by something else, or, you know, it really doesn't challenge the broader point. I mean, I think in the Donald Trump people in particular, there's this sense that they're kind of that some of the facts, it's like quibbling. Like, I love that. I love this description. I heard somebody use this. It's like, well, you know, sure, you know, he didn't do, you know, maybe he got bankrupt a few times, but you're just kind of quibbling. Or, you know, he got out in front of this Egypt Air thing and you know, said it was terrorism when nobody really knows that. But, you know, that's quibbling. We kind of know that it's going to be there. Mm-hmm. You can't really get him for that. And so people will acknowledge the facts, and then they'll still keep their conclusions intact.
Or use the word political correctness. I mean, that we've seen that a lot in the last couple of months. I mean, is that another way of saying someone is wrong?
You know, it's kind of an interesting concept, right? This political correctness, which just kind of says, well, I can be sometimes maybe rude or insensitive or maybe even wrong, and that's okay because you're so hung up on that, right? It's that sense that, you know, the people are hung up on on these little rules that don't matter, and you're just kind of quibbling. Yeah, I mean, I think it's that same mentality, right? That somehow the facts just don't matter as much as you know, this establishment or elites or maybe even liberals think that they do, right? It's like the broader emotional truth is what's important.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Peter Ditto. He's a professor of psychology and social behavior at the University of California at Irvine. Jason Reifler with us as well, associate professor of politics at the University of Exeter in England. And both of them joining us today in Radio Times to talk about why it often feels like the facts don't matter, why there seem to be liberal facts and conservative facts, the Republican facts, the Democratic facts, Hillary facts, Bernie's facts. And you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Something that I had to fix yesterday, I did it on our Facebook page, and I don't mind doing it on the air today, talking about what happened in Las Vegas over the weekend, and there was a question whether Bernie Sanders supporters threw chairs or not. I had read in about, I don't know, half a dozen or so media accounts that indeed had happened, and it looks like it didn't happen. Maybe some chairs were thrown on the floor, or people were holding them very tightly. It's sort of hard to know, but it's tricky to try to, Jason, correct facts, but it seems it's important to do that, especially for a news organization, if you've gotten something wrong.
It is, and I think this highlights sort of different ways in which things can be wrong and how corrections are problematic in multiple domains. So one type of mistake is what we sort of call misinformation. That is, people are exposed to information that turns out not to be correct. So a news account of something happening, and then even after it's corrected, and people recognize the correction and recognize the true thing, that this sort of bit of false information that was out there can continue to have an effect on people's judgments, right, and known as either the continuing influence effect or belief perseverance. So that's problematic in and of itself, that these sort of pieces of false information can have continuing influences even after they've been successfully corrected. And then an additional problem, which is what a lot of what I study with my co-author from Dartmouth College, Brendan Nyhan, is misperceptions, as when people believe things about the world that are just flat out factually incorrect. And one of the things that we find is that oftentimes attempts to correct people's misperceptions, not only do they not work, that they can end up making people's misperceptions even stronger, because you give them this information that they don't want to believe, and so they go through all of the reasons in their head of why it's not true, or why they don't want it to be true, or switching to some alternate justification for why they believe, and that sort of mental process of counter-arguing actually strengthens their belief in these misperceptions by virtue of trying to correct them and disabuse them in the first place.
Peter, let me go back to you. And I talked about whether they're conservative, I don't know, is it facts or liberal facts or perhaps beliefs or world views. Is it that stark?
It is in many ways. And by facts, these words are really fraught, right?
They are. I know that, yes.
You know, facts with little scare quotes on them. But they're what people perceive to be facts. And that's what, you know, we've all heard this expression about you're entitled to your own opinions, but you're not entitled to your own facts.
Right.
Well, what these sort of psychological processes do is they turn opinions into facts in people's heads, right? So people have this sense that, oh, Hillary Clinton's dishonest, right? And then they find beliefs that sort of and little tidbits that sort of support that, and that opinion can be, like, I've got lots of reasons why that's true, or I've got lots of reasons why I think, you know, my sort of beliefs about that the welfare programs are bad, right? I just don't think you should reward people who don't work hard. And if that's your sort of moral inclination, then you're more likely to find, oh, here's a scientific study that seems to support that. Oh, yeah, you know, when you cut welfare, it improves the economy, and you're more likely to accept those things as true, right? So you come up with these things, these kind of hunches. A lot of times there's these moral feelings about what's right and what's wrong, which are really powerful, right? Very emotional, and these emotions just organize people's, you know, what they accept to be true. So you do end up with something that it looks very much like there's red facts and blue facts, and then, like I said, I think those, once you're in that place, what became sort of a difference of opinion becomes a difference of facts, and that's much harder to sort of overcome. It's hard enough to overcome differences of opinion,
sure,
but right, but when they're sort of reinforced by, no, the science says this, or taxes definitely, you know, cutting taxes improves the economy, you know, I can point to economists that say that, you know, then it gets tough for people to find middle ground.
Well, let me pick up on that, Jason, and go to something that I is absolutely true. President Barack Obama is an American. And, you know, if you read some of the research, there's a sizable percentage of the population that does not believe that. But it's true. I mean, there are things like facts, are there not? Even if they might be hard to describe.
Yes, yes. Some things are unequivocally true. Like,
right,
thinking about the example of Barack Obama and being born in Hawaii, is the critic said, what we really need to see is the long form birth certificate, and then the long form birth certificate is finally released, and yet we don't see a big shift in opinion. You know, there are some things that are facts, and not all things are easy to categorize whether they're sort of exactly facts or not. But some things like that, I think, are pretty definitive and clear cut.
We're almost having a break here, but so why would someone believe something that is that false?
They wouldn't believe it because they want to, because they don't like the Democratic Party. They don't like Barack Obama, that it's a way to not have to undermine the legitimacy of a political opponent as a as a politician. If they're perceived as not being eligible to be president, then you don't have to take them seriously. But mostly it's driven just by negative affect, that if you dislike somebody, it suddenly becomes much easier to believe and to repeat strongly negative things about them. I think one of the things that's particularly interesting about a question like this is that's hard to figure out at some level are the people who say that Barack Obama was not born in the United States. And a lot of people say that in surveys, and in particular, a very high proportion of Republicans say that in surveys. And of those who say it in surveys, probably most of them truly believe it. But then again, at the same time, there's probably some that are saying it just as an opportunity to say something negative about Barack Obama. They know they hate Barack Obama, and given any opportunity to say something negative about him, they will.
That's Jason Reifler, who joins us along with Peter Ditto. We are talking about why people believe things that may or may not be true. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This hour of Radio Times, we're talking about why people believe what they do, why it's so hard to change minds, why we cling to political misinformation and even lies. And again, our guests are Jason Reifler, Associate Professor of Politics at the University of Exeter in the UK, and Peter Ditto, Professor of Psychology and Social Behavior at the University of California at Irvine. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Peter, let me go back to 2008, when Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton were duking it out for the Democratic nomination for the presidency. How then was Obama able to win over those ardent Hillary supporters who believed probably very strongly in their candidate, very opposed to Barack Obama running for the White House? How I guess what I'm trying to get at is sort of how do people then change their mind under these circumstances?
Yeah, it's interesting that people, I think, psychologically go through a very similar process than that we see the candidates go through. That, you know, it's at first it's a fight within your own group, and there's some animosity. We see, again, very close analogy this time with Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders as with Obama and Clinton before. And, at that point, your enemy is that person. And all those sort of motivated reasoning effects are focused on that and trying to separate, why Obama is better than Hillary Clinton or vice versa. And then it's just an example of how facile people are at this. And once that's over and you have your person who's relatively close to you, they're in your tribe in a sense, they share lots of similar views, you probably have slightly similar emotional connections, at least their policies, and then you have a different enemy, and then all those things that you've thought about, all the things that the Hillary people thought about President Obama or Senator Obama at the time, then they can just kind of harness those things and direct them at somebody else, and all of a sudden there's some incentive for them to decide that they like Barack Obama, so they harness again implicitly without knowing this, right? They just can kind of focus on the positive things about him and the negative things about John McCain or whoever the enemy du jour is, right? And so people are able to do those kind of maneuvers pretty easily because it's all kind of in the context. What your emotions are organizing your reasoning in ways to sort of support the conclusions that you want to reach.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. We've got Jeff from the main line joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. So this is really a comment. I'm noticing that to talk about different truths, and this is something that theologians have been talking about for some time in our culture, that a truth for me, the existence of God, may not be true for someone else. They don't believe that God exists. And so it sounds like this idea that different truths for different people is you're talking about this in the political realm as well. That's just a comment. I don't know if anyone has anything to say about that.
Well, Jeff, let's find out. Jason, anything you want to weigh in on that? I'm looking at the computer here, and Jeff also made a reference to our screener about moral relativism. I guess the idea that sort of things are fluid or flexible.
I think the caller makes a good point that there's some things that are not knowable. And to the extent that it's possible, you know, on the question of whether there is or is not a God, that's obviously a matter of faith, and there's not any clear-cut evidence on that. But taking that as, you know, one sort of example, and then bringing that back to the world of more concrete facts, it can be difficult to sort of. You know, this is a question I get a lot when I present my work, which is, you know, what exactly makes a fact a fact? And the definition that we try and use in our work is the best available evidence and consensus opinion. So it may be the case that some of the things that are perceived as facts today, things may change in the future, but that's, you know, it's the best definition, working definition that we have available.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Peter, I'm looking at something that you had in the journal Psychological Science, that when you ask someone to explain their political beliefs, that as they are explaining them, they become more moderate. And I'm probably not summarizing it particularly accurately, but tell us what you found.
Maybe
I can quote it here. Asking people to explain what's behind their beliefs seems to make them scrutinize what they know, which in turn can force them to recognize the gaps in their knowledge. As a result, they become less sure of their position and possibly more open to what you have to say.
Sure. You know, that if we're talking, one of the hard things, I guess, is to think about is how to fix any of these problems, how to make people more open, right? So because there is a sense in which people are just resistant. They have these beliefs, and they're almost like possessions, and so they'll defend them. And so the way, you know, there's a couple of ways you can think of that. You know, David Brooks wrote this wonderful, the New York Times wrote this wonderful piece about sort of mental virtues that I liked about sort of talked about, you know, so that people have things like, mental courageousness or mental humility, right? So it's good to kind of get people to be a little bit more humble about the things that they believe. So if they think about them a lot, or if you can get people to sort of recognize that they don't know quite as much as they might believe, right, that somehow you can get them to let information in a little bit better. You know, another way to do that is kind of make people a little bit more sort of mentally courageous, right? So there's a manipulation that's called self-affirmation that's used in experimental studies, where they basically allow people to sort of affirm their view of themselves as a good person generally. And they find that that's one of the most effective ways you can get, if you get people to sort of accept that they're sort of, I'm a pretty good person, then they're likely to be wrong, then they're more likely to sort of accept that they're wrong about certain specifics, right? So it makes you a little bit braver. It's like, well, I know I'm a good person, so maybe I could be wrong about this little thing. And that will, and I can change my mind about that without ruining my sense of myself as a competent person. So there's these interesting little ways to try to open up the gap and make people a little bit more resistant to change. Although I'll have to say, again, I think, you know, these motivated reasoning forces are very powerful. They're a formidable enemy. If you want to try, if reason wants to win out, it's got a tough enemy to beat.
Well, let me go back to you, Jason. And this is something that I've seen Columbia Journalism Review, where you are quoted. For instance, which of these headlines strikes you as the most persuasive? I am not a Muslim, Obama says, or I am a Christian, Obama says. Which is the most persuasive?
So in that one, being able to affirm something that's true, there's some evidence that that is a more persuasive way to try and communicate things. That when you sort of say things in the form of a negative and have, like a not type statement in front of a statement, that in memory, that negative tag can essentially get lost. And so the people remember the underlying claim of Obama is a Muslim more than, say, they would remember Obama is not a Muslim, that negative tag can be more easily forgotten or sort of misplaced. And so the saying these sort of explicit alternative Obama is a Christian is something that there's some evidence that type of semantic structure is more persuasive.
That's interesting.
And if I may sort of add one other thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
Our conversation today, we've kind of, we've been talking about, we sort of used a couple of the, beliefs about Barack Obama, sort of the birther, people who believe that Obama is a Muslim. And so it'd be easy to imagine, especially in the world of motivated reasoning, where conservatives would feel like we're picking on them. And while there's some evidence that suggests that some of these defenses might be more common or more prevalent in conservatives, this type of thing also happens among liberals. This isn't a problem that's dedicated solely to conservatives. The liberals have some of the same sets of problems in terms of not being easily persuaded by evidence or not necessarily updating facts. And I really would be willing to bet, in fact, as I'm saying out loud, I sort of feel like I've missed an opportunity to do a good study, is that I'd be willing to bet Bernie Sanders supporters, if you were to sort of give economic information criticizing his economic plan that comes with an assumption of 5% economic growth, that if you just sort of change the label of whether that's a Democratic or a Republican plan, or change the label of whether it's a Hillary plan or a Bernie plan, that you'd be able to see a lot of the same sort of attachment to the tribe that you like, really dominating how people are processing the underlying information and claims and the evidence that supports them.
So identity, Peter, I mean, in many ways, identity drives so much of what we believe.
Absolutely. And Jason makes a really good point that this is motivated reasoning and these kind of identity processes are it's really a bipartisan bias. Right. And we've done what's called a meta-analysis, where we take out, where we look at sort of quantitatively compare the results of all kinds of studies. So we've tried to find every study where there was sort of a measure, this sort of political bias. So an example would be you give somebody a scientific study and it either supports their beliefs or it doesn't support their beliefs. And there's been lots of studies like this done, and you ask them to evaluate the methodology of that study. And they think it's a really good study if it supports their beliefs, but exactly the same methodology is rated as a terrible methodology if it doesn't support their beliefs, right? So it's really, again, the facts don't matter. It's the conclusion. And if you combine all the studies that we found like that, what you find is that both, and we compared how big the bias was in liberals, how big the bias was in conservatives. And what we found was that both sides show the significant bias. Both sides believe information that supports their beliefs, their ideology more than information that doesn't. Right, when it's closely matched, it's kind of the same kind of content, but just change whether it supports their beliefs or not. Both sides do that, and both sides do it to virtually the identical degree.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right? So liberals like information that supports liberal ideology. Conservatives like information that supports conservative ideology. Everybody sort of sucks up the information that they want, you could bicker about what kind of bias you think is sort of a more benign bias, which I think people do, but it's clear that both sides, ideology biases people's processing of information, and it does it with everybody. Again, we very often sort of pick on conservatives, and there may be some reason why, in the broader scheme, that's a more powerful factor for them. It has to do with media differences as well. But, again, it's important to make the point that everybody does this and everybody sort of supports the beliefs that they want to believe.
And I'm sure, Peter, people in our audience saying, but I'm right. What I believe is right.
Everybody but me. And that's another phenomenon that we see in psychology. It's called the belief bias. That people think people understand bias, right? But they think that they see it very clearly in other people. So they see that other people are biased, but they kind of tend to think that I'm not biased. And that's kind of the problem, is if you don't recognize that you might be biased, you're more likely, you're sort of paradoxically more prone to be biased because you don't control it.
Let me read a comment from Rainier. He says, misinformation from politicians is so common. What is the line between slander and free speech? How is dispensing misinformation allowed by law? I mean, I don't want to get into the law part because we do have free speech here, even if it does include misinformation. But, you know, Jason, there is a suspicion, and I see it on a bunch of comments here, that, you know, the politicians lie, so it just sort of comes with the job description.
Politicians are people who are trying to get office, who are trying to put as, you know, powerful a message forward as they can, and to try and connect back to your first segment with the editor of PolitiFact. Brendan and I have also done some research on fact-checking. One of the things that we've shown is that, you know, if you remind politicians of the existence of fact-checking, that it does seem to limit the degree to which they, shall we say, stretch the truth. They end up being less likely to be caught up in a negative fact check or some other form of accuracy criticism. And so the fact checking has some nice positive effects, even if it doesn't always directly change voters' minds, or if voters use fact checking in this motivated reasoning way that we've been talking about to go and find evidence that their candidate is telling the truth and evidence that the candidate they dislike is not telling the truth. At the same time, there does seem to be some evidence that it does help constrain the extent to which politicians can get away with not telling the truth, right, or stretching the truth. And we never want the sort of standard to be in evaluating fact-checking, does fact-checking stop all lying? The question is, does it limit it? Does it constrain it? Does it sort of help turn the tables and hold politicians accountable? And I think it does that pretty nicely.
Well, we do have to end our conversation. We could go on. Jason Reifler, thank you so much for joining us today on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Associate Professor of Politics at the University of Exeter in the United Kingdom. Peter Ditto, thank you for joining us as well and for getting up so early there in California.
Oh, well, thanks again. Thanks for having me, and it was a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. Professor of Psychology and Social Behavior at the University of California at Irvine, joining us from the studios of KUCL. And we began our conversation with Angie Drobnik-Holen, editor of PolitiFact. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be talking about love after this very short break. We'll be right back. And coming up next on Radio Times, Modern Love. Our guest is Daniel Jones. He edits the series for the New York Times. He has read tens of thousands of personal essays, and he joins us to tell us what he has learned about relationships. That's coming up next here on Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Art and Theater Company supports WHYY and presents The Secret Garden, the Tony Award-winning musical based on the beloved novel by Frances Hodgson Burnett. The Secret Garden tells the story of Mary Lennox and the mysterious Misselthwaite Manor. Mary finds solace in a hidden garden, and with that, a path to rebirth, proving that hope can bloom from the darkest of places. The Secret Garden is on stage now through June 19th. 215-922-1122 or artandtheater.org.
This is WHYY-FM Philadelphia, WNJN-FM 89.7 Atlantic City, WNJZ 90.3 Cape May Courthouse, WNJB-FM 89.3 Bridgeton, WNJM 89.9 Manahawkin, and WNJS-FM 88.1 Berlin.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. It's springtime and love is in the air, from the May prom season to June weddings. There's still an air of mystery about love and romance in spite of all the books and research and so-called experts on relationships. Our guest, Daniel Jones, is not an advice columnist, but he has read thousands of personal essays as editor of the New York Times' very popular series, Modern Love. We asked him to join us to talk about love, romance, and relationships. His most recent book is Love Illuminated, exploring life's most mystifying subject with the help of 50,000 strangers. Stay with WHYY in Philadelphia for more after the news from NPR.